Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of subjects and issues in the news. We'll begin in a moment and look into the confusion over the Libyan intervention following the President's announcement that the US intends to hand over the leadership role to NATO. But within NATO, there are serious divisions over tactics and strategy. Robert Hunter, who was the US ambassador to NATO under President Clinton, joins us. Then we'll look into the possibility of the contagion of democracy in the Middle East spreading to Syria, where there have been recent demonstrations that have been brutally quashed. A specialist on Syria, James Galvin, joins us. Then finally, we'll examine the partisan paralysis that has gridlocked the federal budget, creating a week-to-week impasse in funding the government. We'll be joined by a nonpartisan analyst, Maya McGuinness, who is the president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. I'm now joined by Robert Hunter, who was the U.S. ambassador to NATO under President Clinton and U.S. representative to the Western European Union. He was a principal architect of the new NATO, leading the North Atlantic Council in obtaining airstrike decisions that halted the Bosnian War. He was also director of West European Affairs and later director of Middle East Affairs on the National Security Council during the Carter administration and a principal author of the Carter Doctrine for the Persian Gulf. Thank you so much for joining us on Background Briefing, Robert Hunter.
Good to be with you.
I take it the person who has your old job now has got their work cut out for them in NATO since the president has announced that the U.S. wants to relinquish its leading role, and it doesn't appear that there's much unity within NATO over how to proceed.
Well, I guess that's where it's the most fun, when you have an impossible job as the American ambassador and trying to convince the others to do it in a way which makes eminent sense from the perspective of the United States, but doesn't necessarily make eminent sense from the point of view of all the other allies. It's even worse for my successor, Ivo Dalder, a very able person who is now the U.S. ambassador. I had 15 allies to deal with. He's got 27.
And the fundamental differences seem to be that the Turks specifically have called for a halt to air attacks on ground targets in Libya, which is the price for their ascent. And France doesn't want NATO to take the lead, I guess, and neither does Germany in particular. So let's walk through the main objections, beginning with Turkey. What's their agenda, do you think?
Well, the Turks didn't like the idea of the no-fly zone or military engagement to begin with, even though the Prime Minister, Mr. Erdogan, did say, I guess we could swallow hard and live with a no-fly zone, but nothing else militarily. I think there are a number of things. One is the bad memories of what happened with the invasion of Iraq. Secondly, I think he's looking to his relationship with other Middle East countries, particularly Arab countries, and not wanting to be complicit in military attack that might not be contained. And third, I think the Turks have a good deal of economic interest in Libya and investment in Mr. Gaddafi. And I think even though it's a third issue, I think they want to be a little careful there.
And the French, who don't want NATO to be in the lead, they want a broader coalition. But so far, what are they thinking? It doesn't seem like any of the Arab states except Qatar seem interested in helping out here.
Well, this is part of French theology about their relationship with NATO altogether. Even though a couple of years ago they did rejoin the integrated military command structure, having been out since General de Gaulle pulled them out in 1966. The French view is that, yes, if there's an attack on an allied state within Europe or elsewhere, as the United States was attacked on 9/11, NATO should do that under Article 5 of the NATO Treaty, the North Atlantic Treaty. But when it comes to other activities, unless there is some particular reason why NATO has to do it, the French would rather it was done by someone else. And then the someone else that comes out of this theology to begin with is the European Union, through the thing called, this gets elaborate now, the Common Security and Defense Policy. But, of course, CSDP, as it's called, the European Union, will not take it on because the Germans object. They don't want to see any further military action beyond what is already been sanctioned by the UN. So I think the French are being a little stiff-necked on this. After all, they can't do it. They can't really run it by themselves. The United States is the principal, has the principal capacity for command and control, and the NATO apparatus is unparalleled in the world. So I think the French are being a little stiff-necked on this, looking too much at theology rather than the practical requirements of getting the job done right.
And Robert Hunter, I understand Germany's position is in some ways as a result of the Afghan involvement, which they feel has exacerbated tensions with Europe and the Muslim world. They have just signaled, they've just pulled out their Mediterranean naval force out of the NATO command.
Well, it's not just the issue with regard to relations with the Muslim or even more limited, the Arab world. It's also the very slow progress that the Germans are making in regard to the application of military power outside of circumstances which are either within Europe, like Bosnia and Kosovo, or which have a very clear relationship to the NATO treaty, as with Afghanistan. That is, a member state, the United States, was attacked, which fit under the NATO treaty. I, for one, am a little cautious about criticizing the Germans. I'm old enough to say that if you show me a German pacifist, and historically maybe that's not such a bad thing. Now, as long as they don't block what others want to do, NATO has a history of doing operations where they will take a decision to act, requires unanimity, but not all the allies will participate. For example, the Greeks, who had a very close relationship with the Serbs, in part because of the common Orthodox religion, approved NATO's actions over Bosnia and over Kosovo, but didn't become involved directly in the air attacks.
So finally, the last fly in the ointment appears to be Italy, that has the opposite point of view to the French. They're saying that unless NATO takes the lead, they would reconsider the use of their bases, which are obviously critical to this operation.
Yes, the Italians find themselves in a peculiar situation because they have had this very close relationship with Libya, with Mr. Gaddafi, as a number of allied countries have. I recall when Prime Minister Blair went rushing off to see Gaddafi at one point from the United Kingdom. But the Italians also value very much the relationship with us, the relationship with NATO. So I can understand they're making that point. But again, I hope if some other arrangements worked out, the Italians won't be stiff-necked about it. But as you started off with it, my successor at NATO has got his hands full.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Hunter, who was the U.S. ambassador to NATO under President Clinton, and we're talking about how a deal may be struck, given that the president has signaled that he wants the United States out of the leading role and others to assume that role in this intervention in Libya. And why is it then, Robert Hunter, that given that the French want African Union and Arab League countries into this, in on the ground or in on the air, I guess in this case, why are the Arab countries reluctant? You've got Egypt right next door with a huge air force and army with bases that could reach Libya. And is it because they're tied up dealing with the aftermath of a revolution, or what explains their truculence?
Well, I wouldn't say truculence. The Egyptians, as you say, have their hands full right now. And to expect them to go into some kind of military venture, I think, would be a bridge too far. So that doesn't trouble me at all.
But why are we the ones? I mean, you know, why not a neighbor who's directly impacted if Gaddafi takes over? And he was in the midst of doing so, Egypt will have a great refugee problem, surely, and a dangerous state next door.
They will, but given that they don't really have a government, that they're trying, they've just started to try to sort out a new constitution, which is interim, and the fact that I don't think the Egyptians would be able to do this by themselves. They'd really have to rely upon others for a whole host of things. So I can understand they're not being engaged at this point. I don't have a problem with that. Now, the French are not just talking about having others involved. We in the United States would obviously like that. It's been one of the most important things that did happen prior to the UN resolution was the Arab League did endorse a no-fly zone, as did two other relevant groups, the Gulf Cooperation Council, which is the group of six countries in the Persian Gulf, are all Arabs, and another organization called the Organization of the Islamic Conference, which is all the Islamic countries. They all call for a no-fly zone. Admittedly, they're a little bit of faint-heartedness now that it came so late and Gaddafi seems to be doing so well. But you don't. You could still have NATO in charge in terms of running the operation using the best command and control in the world and have these other countries. It's been done in the past. They're called TCNs, Troop Contributing Nations. They come along. They have the same rights, even some decision-making. So that is not a barrier. In fact, when the United States led a coalition in 1991 to expel Saddam Hussein from Kuwait, President George H.W. Bush worked very hard to get four Arab countries to sign up. They didn't do very much, but the fact that they signed up put the lie to Saddam's claim that this was, to use the words that Gaddafi is using yesterday, a new Western crusade against Islam. That is a very powerful argument for having Arabs engaged in this, but you could do that through NATO just as well as any other way.
Well, apparently next Tuesday in London, there'll be a meeting of 11 Western military contributors, Britain, France, the US, Netherlands, Canada, Norway, Belgium, Denmark, Italy, Romania, and Spain, and Qatar and the EU, and possibly Kuwait and Jordan. I take it that what the diplomats are trying to work out here is a deal that gives NATO military planners power to mastermind the operational side of this air campaign against Gaddafi, while the strategic and political decision-making rests with what the French are trying to put together, which is some kind of political contact group of the participating governments.
Well, frankly, that's the only thing that makes sense. NATO is the organization that can best manage the battle, whatever the battle happens to be. Though I must say that it's not 100% required because these militaries are all professional. They all have a lot of experience with one another. They know how to communicate. And the chances of somebody doing something that they shouldn't or shooting one another down, I think, is extremely remote. They talk about these things all the time. NATO would be more efficient at it, but it's not necessarily required. Now, the big problem here, particularly because the fighting started so late and Gaddafi was able to steal a march, literally and figuratively, on the people who opposed him, is what do you do now? Let us say that the use of military power as sanctioned by the UN to protect civilians doesn't blunt what Gaddafi's doing or leads to a circumstance in which he's still in control of 80 to 90% of the country, and then Gaddafi goes around and starts killing people in his own areas of control, then what do you do? There is no common agreement, for example, as to whether he could be tolerated to remain in power. The President of the United States has said Gaddafi must go. The French have recognized the interim government, or whatever they want to call it, of the rebels. The British Prime Minister wanted Gaddafi to go, but this week he said, well, that's not what this is designed to do. At some point, you got to sort out what is it in reality beyond this limited operation that we are collectively striving for. And having figured that out, and that turns to a great extent on the future of Mr. Gaddafi, how do you bring about the outcome you want? And who does it? And that, as far as I can see, really has gotten nowhere in terms of planning.
So given that this appears to be a tactic in search of a strategic rationale, that the excuse may well be that it really was as it's been stated, which is in sort of an emergency humanitarian intervention, and nobody's particularly thought it through. And there are reports that there were serious divisions within the councils in the White House, where Secretary of Defense and National Security Advisor apparently were very, very, and the Joint Chairman of the Joint Chiefs were very reluctant to use U.S. military force again in intervening in another Arab country. But on the other side, apparently, three women played a role, Hillary Clinton, Susan Rice, and Samantha Power, in terms of what is referred to, I guess, as being liberal interventionists.
Well, that's the kind of wonderful thing we get in Washington as things like this unfold. People start telling stories about who was one place or another. The last 24 hours, the great thing is the three women who engineered this. I don't put a lot of credence in any of that. Maybe one day we'll know for sure what went on. The fact is, the president had a lot of counsel and he took his decision. I wish he had acted sooner. I think it would have been more effective. And I wish maybe some of these Europeans, beginning with the French and the British, who were so, as we say in this country, forward-leaning, I wish they had taken more of the responsibility for moving this onward. But yes, I do believe it was necessary to act in a hurry. If we'd waited another week, if peeps, whoever was doing it, waited another week, there'd probably be nothing to do. That Benghazi would have fallen, and Gaddafi would have started carrying out his pledge to cleanse his country of everybody who opposed him. So I don't have a problem with folks moving too fast. I don't think they move fast enough. Now, there was another issue in addition to the great unresolved issue of what do we do about Gaddafi, which is what happens afterwards. And this applies also in different measure to Tunisia and to Egypt. We have to recognize that for the Europeans and for us and for others, North Africa is going to be, whether you like it or not, a major charge on international action. This started out as an amazingly hopeful, some people call it fourth wave of democracy, some people talk about the second great Arab awakening, but whatever it is, it shows people reaching out within their countries to take charge of their own lives and to move in time in the direction of democracy, an extraordinarily hopeful movement. And then you have pushback by one of these leaders, this thug Gaddafi, starting to slaughter people, that's detracted attention quite properly. But we have to get back on the concern about in time. What about the future? How does one help these people who've thrown off at least two tyrants now, maybe a third in Yemen, maybe a fourth in Libya, and help these people get on with the business of living in the modern world? We have no choice, any of us, but to be involved in that.
Well, just in closing, though, that cries out for some kind of mechanism. It seems to me that since the end of the Cold War, that we have intervened on a number of occasions, largely in the sending our armies off to arrest one tyrant. In the first instance, George Bush's intervention in Panama to arrest a criminal, and then to going after Saddam Hussein twice, and then and the work that you did with President Clinton over getting rid of the criminal leader Milosevic. And in the meantime, these countries get punished one way or the other, either through sanctions or through collateral damage. And the ICC seems to be able to issue indictments, as they're planning to do for Gaddafi. And they've already done that with Sudan's leader, but nothing gets done. And just to finally, it seems to me, with thousands of people, hundreds a day being murdered in the Congo, there's a certain selectivity to our outrage.
Yes, there is a certain selectivity. And I guess, to be honest about it, it's when these things happen closer to home, whether it's the United States in the Western Hemisphere or to the Europeans close to home there, whether it was Bosnia, Kosovo, or now in North Africa, people pay more attention, particularly with refugee flows and just a general propinquity. That does not excuse not doing things like in Rwanda, like getting rid of Mr. Mugabe in Zimbabwe, what's going on now in the Ivory Coast. I think what we're seeing now is finally a dawning of a recognition that there has to be an updating of the international community, is that the right thing, and whether it's through the UN or through some other mechanism, which is going to take more seriously what the UN enunciated a few years ago as the responsibility to protect. Now, it's a long way from here to there. One thing that I argued about myself at the time of Kosovo, where there was no UN resolution for NATO to act because the Russians and the Chinese wouldn't permit it, but everybody agreed something had to be done. Now, we Americans argue that NATO can act within certain areas without a UN, without UN blessing, but most of the Allies, plus the Canadians, argue the opposite. The Allies in particular, because they had the experience of Nazi and then communist lawlessness. But what's not happened, there has not been an updating of international law. There hasn't been a serious effort, or at least not a successful effort, to sit down and say, you know, there are circumstances in which people do these things within their own countries that are so outrageous that there have to be both a legal and a practical means of doing something about it, and to do it in a way so you don't pick and choose, so that you don't say Rwanda is the back of beyond or who cares about Ivory Coast, but we will care about Bosnia and Kosovo. And beginning with the efforts after the Second World War with the U.S., the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, later the Helsinki Final Act and the like, we really do need a lot of very serious thought and then action to be able to broaden this doctrine that people in their own countries have some right to be protected against the onslaught of their own leaderships.
I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Robert Hunter.
I thank you very much.
And again, I was speaking with Robert Hunter, who was a U.S. ambassador to NATO under President Clinton and a U.S. representative to the Western European Union. He was a principal architect of the new NATO, leading the North Atlantic Council in obtaining airstrike decisions that halted the Bosnian War. He was also director of West European Affairs and later director of Middle East Affairs on the National Security Council during the Carter administration and a principal author of the Carter Doctrine for the Persian Gulf. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the brutal crackdown in Syria against demonstrators. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters and this is Background Briefing, and I'm joined by James Galvin, who is a professor of history at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria, the area of present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. He is the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of the Empire, The Modern Middle East, A History, and his forthcoming book, From Modernization to Globalization, The United States, the Middle East, and the World Economy in the 20th Century. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Galvin.
Thank you for having me.
And there have been some rather a brutal crackdown in the southern Syrian city of Daraa. It's difficult to know exactly, because the place has a media blackout, and apparently they've also cut off cell phones in that area. What's your understanding about, because I understand it started with some kids spraying graffiti and the parents came and then the secret police either shot the parents or beat them up. And I mean, it's difficult to get a feeling for it, but I guess the long and the short of it is this a sign of another Arab country starting to show signs of cracking up?
Well, their signs are certainly there. According to the stories that I've been reading in Al Jazeera, the incidents in Daraa actually began with, as you said, children spray painting graffiti. And according to Al Jazeera again, these kids who were in the fifth grade or so were arrested and taken into custody. That's when all hell began to break loose. And there subsequently have been larger and larger demonstrations that have been taking place in Daraa. More children were also arrested, this time for taking part in their own impromptu demonstration. I believe it was last Sunday. And these things have spread now. It's not just Daraa. It's Damascus as well has seen small protests. But also in Banias, you see them as well. And, you know, in Homs, you see these things as well. There were approximately 2,000 demonstrators on the streets of Homs, for example, today. So it is spreading. I think the key element that we are going to have to watch out for is to see if this thing really goes viral in Syria is what's going to happen in the two major cities. The capital city of Damascus, which it's understandable, there's a very, very strong police presence and government presence there, so it's very understandable if it doesn't take off in Damascus. But the northern city of Aleppo as well is very, very important, and the question is whether or not this sort of demonstration is going to move out of a provincial center like Daraa into a major metropolitan center like Aleppo.
Well, we have memories, and I imagine the Syrian people are sort of terrified by the memories of what happened in Hama when Hafez al-Assad, the father of the current leader, the accidental leader, the ophthalmologist from London, his son, when I think 25,000 people were brutally murdered in the way that Gaddafi is using artillery and modern equipment on his own civilian population. That was mostly the Muslim Brotherhood, though, wasn't it?
That was a Muslim Brotherhood uprising. There are certain lessons that can and cannot be drawn from that. I don't think that the Syrian population was permanently cowed by that. If we look, for example, we see rebellions taking place in various junctures against Saddam Hussein, who certainly resorted to the same sort of criminal acts against his own population, and as you mentioned, Gaddafi as well. There is another lesson, though, that is to be learned, however, from what happened in Hama, which is the fact that most of the population sat on its hands. In other words, you had a rebellion that took place against the regime, and the rebellion didn't spread, and it was quickly contained by very, very brutal means. But the population at that time was not prepared, was not willing to see a Muslim Brotherhood takeover of Syria.
And is there, I've often wondered how this regime, the Assad regime, the Lions as they call themselves, how do they hold on to power given that they represent a 15% minority of Shiites in a Sunni country? They're the members of the Alawite sect.
Right, that's absolutely true. But I don't think too much can be read into the sectarian divisions. I mean, people tend to do that, for example, looking at what's going on in Bahrain as being a Sunni-Shi sort of thing. The ruling group in Syria certainly is Alawite. But this has nothing to do, of course, with religion. It has to do mainly with access to patronage and trust on the part of the Assad people for their own members of their own groupings. Actually, it's very interesting that almost all these people who are in high government positions hail from the same port city of Latakia, whereas there are Alawites all over Syria. So they hold power not just because they don't distribute power to outsiders, only to people that they trust. But they also make cross-sectarian alliances as well with Sunni merchants, for example, with certain industrialists who are either Christian or Sunni as well. The power remains in the hands of a very, very select few, that's true. But that select few is has the spigot for the economy, has the patronage for the economy, which other people outside of that small community are actually able to tap into.
And James Galvin, would that explain why, for the last several decades under the Assad family rule, the economy has been absolutely zero growth?
Yeah, the economy is not doing too well. In the Arab region, first of all, the decade of the 1980s was a complete disaster anyway. They call it a bad decade for Latin America, for example, a missed decade, which had 2% growth. Middle East growth was absolutely flat throughout that period. The Syrian economy is reliant upon two major forms of export. Oil, hydrocarbons, to begin with, is the most important, and that makes about 25% of the government's revenue. The other is agricultural. There's a very, very large agricultural sector. About 25% of the employment is in the agricultural sector. And actually, Syria is one of only two countries in the region that is self-sufficient in foodstuffs. One of the reasons why we've seen these demonstrations spread throughout the Middle East is that the Middle East as a whole is more reliant on imported wheat in particular than any other region in the world. And there's been all sorts of reasons why the price of wheat has skyrocketed in the last year or so. But it certainly has skyrocketed, and this, of course, created a great deal of dissatisfaction among populations that spend 40-50% of their income on food. In Syria, that is not the case, however, and Syria is actually a food exporter. So there are certain sectors of the economy which do okay for the country, but you're absolutely right. It's an economy that is still tightly regulated by the government. It's an economy in which there is currency controls. There's no transparency whatsoever. It's rated very, very low on all the indexes of transparency, privatization, and so on and so forth.
Well, let me just, in the last minute here, Professor James Galvin, get a sense of how long the Syrian regime can hold on. Particularly, they've been using the Israel bogeyman for so long, and they're using on state television now their excuse for the hundreds of people that apparently have been shot and wounded in this city of Daraa is that they were inspired by the Israelis.
Well, at least they're not inspired by al-Qaeda using hallucinogenic drugs, which we've heard before.
Right.
The population has knows the regime. They know what they're dealing with. There's really no way that the population is going to believe the sort of things that these dictators have used.
Well, I'm afraid that's all the time we have. I'm sorry, but I've enjoyed speaking to you here today, UCLA Professor James Galvin, the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism, and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of the Empire. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with a nonpartisan analyst about the federal budget impasse. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and I'm now joined by Maya McGuinness, who is the president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, a bipartisan nonprofit organization committed to educating the public about issues that have significant fiscal policy impact. She also directs the Fiscal Policy Program at the New America Foundation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Maya McGuinness.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And Maya, where do we stand? This train wreck with the budget, this impasse, it involves 2 years, doesn't it? Or have they sorted? Which year are we on now?
Well, right now the focus in Congress is on how to pass the budget for this year, the year that we're in, which should have been passed last fall. Every year before the fiscal year begins, which is at the beginning of October, we're supposed to have passed a budget and all the appropriations bills to fund that. That didn't happen last time, and so we have now reduced this conversation to it would be comical if it weren't so sad, but funding the government on a couple week bases at the time, and that is just for this year. We also are about to start to engage in the work of passing a budget for next fiscal year, which will start in October, and I can promise everyone that is going to be a very challenging discussion as well, passing that budget. And then there's, of course, the bigger pressing issue, which is we have huge fiscal challenges facing us, and we need to come together as a country and as parties and put together a multi-year comprehensive budget plan, which would basically put the U.S. Budget back on track to avoid any kind of fiscal wall that we're currently on track to hit.
So I take it then, Maya McGuinness, that the budget impasse perhaps explains the public's disapproval of Washington. It may be a big part of that. The Washington Post poll recently indicated that.
Well, I don't think that there is anything encouraging about watching two parties battle it out and not get the basic business of governing done. I can say I'm a political independent, and I, like other voters, watch this and just sort of with absolute frustration of you can't show up to your own job and fight so much that you don't get the work done. Passing a budget is the single most basic thing that the government has to do, and it's all the more important than it ever has been before because we're on such precarious fiscal ground as it is. The creditors around the world watching the U.S. wondering should they continue to lend their money to the U.S. at such low rates. can't be reassured by this. So I think it's very frustrating for voters. I think it's a very bad signal to send to markets. And I know my feeling is I wish that folks would just roll up their sleeves and solve the problems. We're spending too much and not paying for it. We're taxing too little, spending too much, borrowing too much in a way that is destabilizing the economy at a time when we need to be thinking about how to make sure this economic recovery sticks and the economy grows in the longer term. And I wish that we sort of could get back to basics of what should our budget look like, how are we going to pay for it, and how are we going to avert the kinds of crises that we would have if we don't. So I think I probably find it as frustrating as all the folks who took that poll find it.
And Maya McGuinness, in terms of the deficit, you say you're a deficit warrior as opposed to a deficit hawk. But let's get some of it straight here for the public. My understanding is that the immediate blowout in the deficit was a result of two unfunded wars and the rescue of the near-death experience for the global economy on Wall Street in 2008. Am I correct?
Well, there are a number of things that have contributed to where we are fiscally. We were running surpluses not all that long ago, and we proceeded to change a lot of policies. There were the tax cuts of 2001 and 2003 that President Bush passed, and then President Obama recently extended those tax cuts, and both those rounds of tax cuts have made the fiscal situation worse. There are two unfunded wars. There was the Medicare prescription drug plan, which we put in place with no plan to pay for it, adding to our massive health care costs. And then, of course, there was the devastating effects of the economic downturn and the cost of the stimulus that we put in place to deal with that. Now, when the economy turns down, that's when you actually want to run deficits. That's the appropriate time. You want to run surpluses when the economy is strong. And so if we hadn't been borrowing for all these other things, it would have been, as big as the recession was, we would have been in a better fiscal spot to deal with it. But going forward, the problems are very different. Going forward, it's not the war cost, it's not even the tax cuts that are causing the problem. The problem is our aging of our population and growing health care costs. Those are the two biggest squeezes in the budget, and those translate into our biggest government programs, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, where with health care costs going as fast as they are, that's and a larger population collecting benefits for those and Social Security, that puts immense upward pressure on the budget. And we need to decide as a country whether how we're going to reform those programs, whether we want to spend more to pay for all of them, or maybe change some of our priorities and put more in public investments perhaps. But we need to recognize that the biggest problems going forward, aging and health care. It's a good thing we're living longer, but it does cost a lot of money.
Again, I'm speaking with Maya McGuinness, president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget at the New America Foundation. It seems to me that there are twin deficits that mirror each other, the household debt and the national debt. And as we know from the recent Deficit Commission and from the work by Pete Peterson, who has a major deficit hawk who's been spending his money in order to bring attention to his point of view, shall we say. But very little attention is paid to the household debt, which has doubled in the last 30 years prior to this 2008 meltdown. Why is it then that the public aren't brought into this in a more engaged way? Because I think they're quite concerned about their own situation. And the broader one is something of an abstraction, or some argue a distraction.
Well, I think it's hard to really personalize the damage that budget deficits and excessive federal debt does to us on a personal level. How you put a human face on this is one of the bigger challenges in how you talk about it. But there's no question that these massive budget deficits affect every one of us in our daily lives. In fact, one of the effects of having run budget deficits for so long is that our incomes are actually lower than they would have been if we had been saving more and investing more in the past and growing our economy for having done that and keeping the returns from that growth here at home. We've been borrowing so much of our investment capital from abroad that much of the returns have gone overseas, and other countries' standards of living are growing faster than our own. But it's a hard case to make, right, that if only we hadn't borrowed so much and our taxes had been higher and our spending had been lower, we'd actually be making more money. But what it also does is it creates real threats going forward. So whether it's for retirees, where if we don't fix these programs soon, the solutions are going to end up hitting more and more people. If we don't make changes to Social Security in 25 years, and that won't happen, we'll obviously be smart enough to make changes in advance of that, but there would suddenly be a massive 22% across-the-board cut, including on current retirees and those who depend on the program. That is no way to fix Social Security. You want to put those changes in advance. It affects people in terms of their job security, their pensions, their health care costs, and how much of it is subsidized by the government, their tax levels, and basically how well the economy is doing and what their own economic prospects are. So we are going to see either thoughtful changes made now, and they're not going to be easy. One of the bottom line lessons here is it's going to take everything, all parts of the budget, to fix the situation. But we can do it in a thoughtful way that's actually good for the economy and protects those who depend on programs the most now. Or we can wait until markets force us to, and then we're going to have some pretty draconian measures, which are done much less thoughtfully and probably harm the economy with much higher tax rates and slashing of government spending at a time when the economy would otherwise be too weak. So there really is no argument to delay making these changes, and I do recognize the sort of difficulties in making people turn this into a kitchen table issue. But I also think voters are well ahead of policymakers here, that they do understand kind of a simple principle, which is you can't spend more than you take in year after year after year. And that's what the federal government's doing. And I think a lot of people feel like, well, we have to kind of tighten our belt at home in a way that's not borrowing excessively. And the federal government has to stick to that kind of simple principle. And bottom line is that's true.
But, Maya McGinnis, you're suggesting that there are actually easy ways to do this in terms of the entitlements and the benefits. You're saying that it's very doable to change the benefits that provide more for the well-off and less for those who really need it, that you could reverse that equation. Is that politically possible? I mean, it's obviously, you also talk about how, just in a recent article, that there are disturbing trends in income inequality, which are a national problem, and that millionaires and billionaires should make some sacrifices or more sacrifices. So walk me through those two, because they are related, obviously.
Well, let me just start by saying I don't say that reforming entitlements will be easy. It really won't be easy to do. But you can do it in sensible ways that are going to protect people who need the programs the most. So if you take Social Security, for instance, well, there are basically three pieces of changes we can make to strengthen Social Security and make it solvent again for going indefinitely in the future. And those are looking at how long we work or raising the retirement age, slowing the growth of benefits that are growing much faster than inflation, and raising revenues. And I basically say that we should raise the retirement age for people who can work longer and protect those who can't, and that we should slow the growth of benefits, but far more so on the high end for the people who don't need their benefits in order to protect people on the low end. And I, and in fact, most people who want to think about how to fix Social Security, all support increasing actually a minimum benefit, which would really protect low-income workers and ensure that anybody who worked a full lifetime doesn't live in poverty. I think that should be part of the deal. And I'm not arguing that it's easy, and I'm certainly not saying politically that it's easy, because Social Security, of all the topics out there, that's the hot-button issue. But it, to me, doesn't make sense to delay and put people who really need Social Security in a vulnerable situation by not knowing what they can expect down the road when we could make more gradual changes now. Healthcare is a lot harder. We don't know how to fix all of healthcare. I would say that we can't have an open-ended promise on healthcare like we do right now. We're going to have to start budgeting for healthcare, where we actually put limits on how much we spend on healthcare at the government level, and then find different ways to control those costs. One of the ideas that's out there is premium support or a form of vouchers. Other ideas are to create a public option and use that big pool to help put pressure on costs. Those are two ideas at separate ends of the ideological spectrum. I am not wed to anything as much as I am to trying to figure out what works on controlling healthcare costs, but we have to step away from the notion that we can have it all in healthcare without paying for it, because that's just pushing up costs to unmanageable levels. Finally, on revenues, we are going to have to raise taxes. The notion that no new taxes can last forever just is not at all consistent with how much we've shown that we want to spend and how much we've borrowed. And I happen to think that the income inequality trends that we're seeing in this country are very, very troubling. And so while I actually reject the sort of promises of not raising taxes on people making lower than $250,000 a year, that's not going to work. We're going to have broad-based tax increases. Everybody's going to have to be part of the solution. But I do think asking people who can afford to pay more should certainly be part of that solution as well. And so there have recently been proposals for new millionaire and billionaire surtaxes, and I think that that certainly should be part of the debate of how we close the fiscal gap. Again, bottom line, everything's going to have to be part of the solution. Defense is going to have to be there. Domestic discretionary is going to have to be there. I think we should be looking at different forms of taxes, perhaps an energy tax. Certainly, entitlement reform is going to be the center of this. That's where the biggest problem is. But anybody who thinks that there can be sort of major pieces of the budget taken off the table just hasn't gone through the numbers enough. The
But just focus on something you just said, though. You say that the entitlement is the biggest problem. I thought Social Security paid for itself, and it was good for another 20, 30 years.
If only that were true. Unfortunately, Social Security is now running cash flow deficits. And while the money has been put away in the trust funds and Social Security has a claim on government revenues for the next 25 years, it doesn't have the money to pay for those benefits. And so the rest of the government is going to have to provide it to Social Security to the tune of about $600 billion over the next decade. Now, we may decide that that's our most important priority and that that's what we should do. But it also, these large deficits in the Social Security program, which we're now being faced with, necessitate that we at least think through whether that's how we want to be spending the $600 billion next year. And if so, where's it going to come from? Because the trust funds, the way government trust funds work, is it's not set aside in a way that has been saved. It was set aside in the way that it financed other government priorities. Now the government's going to have to kind of pony up and figure out where to find that money, and that will not be an easy task.
Well, let's just turn to the notion that you mentioned earlier, Maya McGuinness. Again, I'm speaking with Maya McGuinness, president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget at the New America Foundation. You mentioned that you run deficits during a recession, and we are in a deep recession. But we also know that it's politically impossible now for another stimulus, and the original stimulus, no Republican voted for it. And the partisanship in this situation, to me, is poisonous to the point where I'm wondering whether there is a deliberate effort here to destroy this presidency by having the economy go into the toilet. I see a lot of evidence to that effect, and the resistance to doing anything about stimulating the economy when it's needed. And it seems to me in many ways the arguments of focusing on the deficit are a distraction from that immediate need. And when you have the fact that Clinton wooed Wall Street and the Democrats got some money and then Palmer seemed to close the deal, now in 2010, Wall Street has switched now to support the Republicans. And in 2012, they're likely to do the same. It seems like Wall Street is hostile towards this president, who has been nothing but kind to them. At the same time, Wall Street is largely responsible, from my understanding, for gaming the price of oil and other basic commodities that go into food, like grains and stuff. Obviously, there have been some harvest problems around the world. But my understanding is that I talked to the former head of the Commodities and Futures Trading Commission the other day, who said that there's an enormous amount of gaming going on, as there was back in 2008 in the price of oil. So who's in charge of this country, Wall Street or the president?
Wow. That was a bit of a loaded question, I'm going to say.
Well,
and I'm going to start by correcting you. We're actually not still in a recession. The recession has been over. We are in a situation where the recovery is not as strong as it should be. And the real terrible part of this, of course, is that jobs have not come back, as they are likely to lag in any recovery. But we're not in a recession anymore, as declared by NBER, who's sort of in charge of saying when we are and we aren't in a recession. And we're now in a very difficult situation of straddling two economic goals, one to deal with keeping the economic recovery on track and hopefully speeding up the process of creating jobs, which I think can only happen when there's more stability in the economy, and part of that's related to the fiscal situation, and two, dealing with our massive deficit and debt overload so that we don't have another crisis, which many people predict would be much larger than what we just experienced if we don't get these under control. In terms of the partisan finger-pointing that you kind of just went through, I just don't find that productive. I don't think that the focus should be on this party does that and that party does that. I think the focus should be here are the multiple challenges we, the country, have, and how can we work together to solve them? So I just feel like the clock is ticking on taking seriously these real fiscal challenges that we have, and the best thing we can do is stop the finger-pointing and expect our leaders to figure out together how to solve the problem.
But you don't think one party has an investment, as the Republican head of the Senate said in the last election, his main goal is to get rid of Obama. My feeling is that as this president tries to get us out of this recession, and you say we're out of it, but the recovery is pretty thin, if you've got people on Wall Street who are gouging the American people on basic commodities like gas and food, that is slowing down the recovery. And I'm wondering whether there's a partisan investment in sabotaging the economy, or at least slowing the recovery, in order to win the next election. It's not, I'm not taking sides so much. Well, perhaps I am taking sides.
You are.
You are, right. Well, would you? What's your opinion on that then?
I think to accuse one political party of trying to sabotage the economy is not particularly responsible. I think both parties hope that they'll win in the next election. I think that is the nature of politics. But do I think that either party is honestly trying to tank the economy? Absolutely not. I think there are legitimate different points of view about the role of government that Republicans and Democrats see with each other. And my hope is that they would recognize that there are particularly important moments in our history where you're not going to get your perfect proposal. You know, the government is probably going to be bigger than Republicans want and smaller than Democrats want. There is going to have to be some compromises. And if we don't move quickly from the sort of letting the perfect be the enemy of the good, or posturing instead of cooperating, we will run out of time to fix these challenges.
Well, what
but
about
to me, it is not at all responsible even to suggest that one party is out there honestly trying to tank the economy. Working with members of both parties, I just find that completely at odds with anything you see from people who have legitimate different points of view, but honestly believe that what they're doing is the right thing.
Well, I'm putting two things together. What Mitch McConnell said and the old mantra from the Clinton days, it's the economy, stupid. And my understanding from almost every political scientist on the planet is that it's very hard to get reelected when you have a lousy economy. And that's the source of my cynicism, because I don't think Wall Street's helping if they're running up the price of oil just to make money out of speculation.
Well, you've made your point, and I disagree.
Okay. All right. Well, I thank you so much for joining us.
Yep. Thank you.
Bye-bye. I'm Ian Masters, and I was speaking with Maya McGuinness, who's the president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget at the New America Foundation. This has been a Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, your rabid, ranting, and opinionated moderator. I would like to thank my producers, Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. Our theme music is by Los Lobos. You can hear this program, sign up for podcasts, and contact me at ianmasters.com. I'm also writing a daily blog. Go to ianmasters.com and click on blog. You may leave comments, and I would love to know what you think. I'll be back tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.